The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you watch enough police procedurals and crime shows like CSI, you would think that DNA evidence is a slam dunk. It's a little more complicated in real labs where technicians have to interpret data based not only on science, but often making judgment calls. The irony is that with forensic scientists now able to detect mere traces of DNA, comes the possibility of a mix, that innocent people could be connected to a crime scene. That's at the heart of a case being made for one man imprisoned in Georgia. Journalist Chris Burdick investigated the case, one of several challenging the precision and accuracy of genetic evidence. We read his article, The Unraveling of DNA Forensics in Playboy. And Chris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So almost every cell in the human body carries a complete set of DNA. Hair, skin, bone, saliva, all of it. But each person's DNA is remarkably close to others. How close, and how does forensics make that distinction?
So we all share about 99.9% of our DNA. In that 0.1%, that's where forensic scientists look for these genetic markers. They look in typically about 13 to 20 locations on the genome where there is substantial variation from person to person.
So people can share some of the same markers, but there's another phenomenon that you introduced in your article called the DNA mixture, which can seriously compromise the accuracy of looking at one person versus another for a crime. Now, what's going on there?
One big problem with DNA forensics is that the testing has become so sensitive that it can pick up even nanograms worth of DNA. So, for example, if you were to get your friend a beer at a party, and your friend drank the beer, then left it, and later that night, some drunk smashed the bottle and killed somebody with it. A forensic scientist swabbing that bottle would get saliva DNA from your friend, touch DNA from you when you handed it over, touch DNA from the murderer, blood DNA from the victim. They would be all mixed up, and there is no real way to tell when DNA was put on a piece of evidence.
This comes into play in the case of Kerry Robinson. He's a man from Moultrie, Georgia, convicted for taking part in a gang rape. Now, who is he and why is his conviction even in doubt?
His conviction is in doubt because in this mixture, his DNA matched the evidence sample at only two spots out of 13. And studies of DNA forensics and the databases that are kept by the FBI have shown that perhaps one out of five people might share 20% of DNA with any given random person. So it's not at all clear-cut. The DNA forensic expert from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation said that Kerry could not be excluded as a suspect.
Why didn't his defense lawyer bring up the issue of DNA mixing at the trial?
He didn't know what he was doing. Essentially, it's a very complicated subject. It's a matter that you really need to bring in a geneticist expert testimony. That costs money. He did talk to a biology professor at a local state college about what DNA was and how that worked, but he didn't know about the vagaries of interpreting DNA mixtures and how it can go awry.
This is the thing that comes up over and over again in this article, is that we had this idea that DNA evidence is incontrovertible. You know, people who've been in jail for years have been wrongly convicted or proven to be wrongly convicted and let out of jail. But you point out that there are a lot of things that can actually both compromise DNA and also make those readings of it a lot less accurate. What are some of the things that are being challenged now?
So one thing that happens to all DNA is that it can degrade. Heat and light can cause parts of the DNA signal to just disappear. So one thing that forensic analysts are faced with often is not simply a mixture of DNA and which DNA came from what person, but some of that DNA may just be missing pieces. So they have to account for that. Because it is such a small amount of DNA, there's a phenomenon called DNA transfer, where if you sneeze, some of your DNA may go onto a surface. Even when you speak, a little saliva can come out. When you touch a knife or a doorknob, you leave DNA there. And it can transfer from place to place. There's a famous case study out of Germany where German police were baffled by a wave of crime that was connected to this specific DNA profile. They didn't know who it was, and in the end, it ended up being a bit of touch DNA from a woman who worked in the factory where they created the swabs that the investigators used.
So what is the likelihood of a completely uncompromised sample of DNA making its way into the lab and then the courtroom?
If there is a match at all 13 locations of the DNA fingerprint, the statistics are pretty overwhelming. The issue is that there almost never is that kind of a match. And you now have mixtures of multiple people's DNA in the evidence samples in most of the cases that DNA is used in, partly because DNA is being used so often now.
We're talking with Chris Burdick about the conviction of a Georgia man on gang rape charges based on what looks like a faulty read of DNA evidence. Chris's investigation for Playboy opens up some questions about the reliability of DNA evidence. So in Robinson's case, it was in Georgia that these lab samples were analyzed. Are there any kind of national standards for crime labs that helps codify how these kind of markers and DNA mixtures are analyzed?
There is no national standard for that at this point. And these markers are different. Scientifically, there is some more likelihood of sharing a genetic marker at one of these locations versus another. But right now, it's up to the labs whether or not they count two markers as being good enough to connect a suspect, or if they think that you need to have more. It's supposed to be based on a statistical weighing of that evidence, so that when you come to court with two matching markers, you should say, based on what we found, there is a 5 million to 1 chance that it was the suspect rather than a random person. But the problem is with how the analysts do their statistics, they often take shortcuts and don't report that accurately.
The Robinson family is still trying to clear Carrie's name. In fact, an investigative reporter took up the case at a local news station in Georgia. What did they find when they ran a test in their newsroom?
So they basically submitted DNA from 5 people in the newsroom to be tested against the mixture that was found at the crime scene where Carrie was convicted. Carrie was convicted based on evidence that his DNA matched the mixture in 2 of 13 locations. And what they found was that among the 5 people at the newsroom that they randomly selected to submit their DNA, all of them matched to the same extent or more strongly the evidence from the crime.
And the evidence from the crime was given another testing. A scientist at Boise State that you spoke to, he sent it out for independent analysis. What happened there?
So he sent the evidence to an accredited crime lab and had it looked at independently by 17 forensic scientists there and asked them whether the DNA from Carrie matched the evidence sample. Actually, they didn't name Carrie at all, so it was all very blind in terms of the scientists. What they found was that only one of the 17 scientists agreed with the conclusion of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation that Carrie Robinson could not be excluded from the evidence sample. 4 of them thought it was inconclusive, the evidence was too mixed up. But 12 of them thought, based on the evidence, that Carrie Robinson should be excluded from the evidence sample of the crime.
So with all this uncertainty with DNA testing, how prevalent are false convictions based on DNA?
So while there have been 2 known false convictions based on misinterpretation of DNA evidence, the problem really is that you're talking about interpretation. Only when you will occasionally have a mix-up in the lab or some other way that the real culprit comes to light is really the only way that you are able to disprove what a forensic expert on the stand said was his or her interpretation. In other cases, you are more or less at the mercy of the jury.
Well, with so many overcrowded labs and courtrooms, the likelihood that any evidence would be retested, as it was in the case of Carrie Robinson, is pretty slim, I would imagine.
It's true, although now some of these mix-ups have been coming to light And when they do then re-examine the evidence, such as they have done in Texas to a great extent and in Washington, D.C., where they found a few errors, and when they started digging, they've been finding a lot more. So far, none of these errors have brought a reversal of a courtroom decision. But in Texas, for instance, they are reviewing thousands of cases where mixture DNA was part of the evidence. And in some cases, they are finding where the expert said on the stand that it was a million to one shot, that it was a random person contributing to the DNA, was actually more like 10 to one. So there are some troubling findings coming out of recent reviews of the cases.
With the new evidence for Kerry Robinson, what is his current status?
He is still incarcerated. He is set to be released in 2023 if his current appeal with the Georgia Supreme Court is not heard. As of yet, they do not know whether or not the Supreme Court in the state will take up his case or not.
So, Chris Burdick, with these problems of DNA testing, interpretation, and possible compromise, how is this problem of DNA testing being addressed?
Well, one way is to use software. This is not without controversy, but it is a way to lessen the human error that is often involved here. There are a number of software products on the market and others being developed. The controversy with these, though they seem to do well when tested out against lab samples and mixtures that are created in the lab, is that they are essentially a black box. So you cannot put them on the stand as a defense lawyer and question the reasoning that led to the software's pronouncement of a suspect being included in the evidence or not. And so they are still quite controversial, but it is a promising avenue for dealing with some of the human error.
I also found it interesting that there are calls for crime labs to be made independent of police and prosecutors. So is there potential for conflict of interest in some cases?
There is potential for that. And that has been a call for some years now, since I think 2009, when a big report on forensic science generally was put out by the National Research Councils. They basically said that there is potential for conflict of interest because forensic scientists essentially work for prosecutors. They work for law enforcement. They are often compensated more for evidence that leads to convictions. And so there is an issue there.
Well, Chris, thanks for all your work on this. A fascinating case. And thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks very much.
Chris Burdick, he's a freelance science journalist and author. His piece, The Unraveling of DNA Forensics, examines the case of Kerry Robinson and some of the uncertainty now becoming synonymous with DNA testing. You can find a link to read it yourself. It's got fantastic illustrations as well at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2015, nearly half of patent cases filed in the country ran through the U.S. District Court of East Texas, and more than a quarter ended up in front of one small-town judge. It's not that Texas is a hotbed of innovation, but that the mostly rural district made some tweaks to its rules to speed up the process of settling patent cases. Those adjustments were made back in the early days of the tech revolution. Since then, patent holders and the trolls who leverage them in infringement cases have flocked to the district, known to be friendly to their cause. Kaylee Rogers is staff writer for Motherboard, and she wrote the article, "The Small Town Judge Who Sees a Quarter of the Nation's Patent Cases." Kaylee, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you wrote about the town of Marshall, Texas, in this district, East District, where Judge Rodney Gilstrap provides over more than a quarter of the nation's patent cases. Who is he?
So he is a judge. He's not originally from Marshall, which everyone in the sort of small town will make sure they let you know right away, but he's been living and working in the area for a long time. He was originally a lawyer, became a judge, and he sort of inherited this system that made it really appealing for patent trolls, and he's kind of gone along with it and embraced it as a way to see a lot of these IP cases.
Yeah, so this is just one judge in one town, but the whole Eastern District of Texas has been attracting these patent cases. Now, when did that start and why?
So that really started back in the 90s. So Texas Instruments, who you should be familiar with, so they decided to start leveraging some of the patents that they held on different technology. Things were not as profitable, and so they started filing patent lawsuits just to make sure that they were making the most of the patents that they did hold. since they're based in Dallas, that's where they filed their original cases. But the thing with patent cases is they can be kind of bumped down the docket. They're not really priority compared to criminal cases. And so Texas Instruments wasn't getting their cases heard very quickly. So they kind of went looking around in the area, you know, where's somewhere else that's maybe a little sleepier docket that we can start filing these patent cases and get them heard more quickly. And that's sort of how they found Marshall.
So they can choose where they want their patent case to be heard?
So this is an interesting sort of weird loophole with IP litigation where the patent holder gets to choose where they file their case, and it can be pretty much anywhere that you could argue the patent is being used. And so when you're looking at stuff that's tech or internet related, that can be really anywhere in the country. If you have a patent that has to do with selling things online, as long as the company you're suing sells things in the state or the district where you're suing them, so if people have access to the internet there, then you can make the case that you can sue them there.
Texas Instruments was looking for a more efficient place to have these patent cases go through. And you found that one judge in particular sort of changed the rules in order to make it more attractive to patent litigation. How did that happen?
Right. So Judge T. John Ward, who was there in the 90s, was seeing all these patent cases. And he had worked actually before he became a judge. So he'd worked as a local counsel on one of Texas Instruments' patent cases, and he was chatting with, you know, his fellow colleagues that were in from California, and they were kind of complaining, you know, like, we have rules in California that makes patent litigation go a little quicker. I really, really should they have that here. So by the time he became judge and started seeing more and more of TI's cases, he thought, well, I'll look at what they're doing in California, and I'll see if I can just adopt some of those rules here, which is what he did.
So this is the initiation of the so-called rocket docket. What is the rocket docket specifically?
So the rocket docket was the result of these sort of efficient rules. They just set up certain timetables and limits the number of document pages, just ways to sort of make things more efficient. And at that time, it meant that the patent cases in Marshall were being settled in 2 years or less, which gave it the name the rocket docket. That's a very quick turnaround time for these kind of cases.
So 2 years from file to trial, I guess, is what they were saying down there.
Absolutely. And that was very appealing to patent holders, and in particular, these sort of patent trolls, which we've been learning more and more about over the last few years.
Yeah, let's dig into that, if you don't mind. What is the distinction between a patent troll and a patent holder?
So a patent holder traditionally is someone who has the original idea for a product or an innovation. They hold the patent on it, and then that way, if someone tries to, you know, steal their idea, they can sue for the rights to it. The difference with patent trolls, they're technically called non-practicing entities, or NPEs. Basically, they're organizations or companies that just buy up a bunch of unused patents, and this is strictly so that they can sue for them and make a lot of money. They're not actually making any products or providing any kind of service. They're just suing to make money off of these patents.
Yeah, and there's a lot of complaint that in just leveraging patents in order to make money by suing people for infringement, they are actually slowing down innovation. Do you get a sense from what's going on there in East Texas if that's true?
Definitely. So the so-called rocket docket actually became much more slower as more and more patent troll cases were brought to the area. It's just kind of hard to juggle all of this work that's being done. And so it slows things down. And at the same time, the argument that's made is that it costs money. It's estimated that these suits cost somewhere around $29 billion a year. That number was kind of from 2011, so it's probably more than that by now. And, you know, it just kind of goes against both the whole reason why we have the legal system set up as well as the patent system set up, you know, it's to protect ideas and encourage people to innovate and create new things and not have to worry about someone stealing that idea. It's really not so that shell companies can, you know, get a bunch of money out of big tech companies just by being clever and using these loopholes.
So the patent trolls and patent holders, we must, you know, note that there are many legitimate cases here. Mm-hmm. They're flocking to this East District in Texas. Why? Do they tend to see a favorable return on their cases there?
So there's a number of things that have been put in place to kind of make the Eastern District more appealing to patent holders. In the end, it just kind of amounts to it being more friendly to them. They're more likely to win. One thing is that they more often go to trial there. Trials statistically favor the patent holder more than the defendant. And also, trials are very expensive and they're lengthy. And if you're a big tech company that's trying to get this patent troll out of your hair and they say, you know, we'll go away if you give us $100,000, sometimes that's the price you're willing to pay rather than have to go through all the cost and time of an actual trial.
Yeah, there must be a lot of benefit for a town or a district that hears a lot of these big cases.
Definitely there is. You know, that's one sort of strange side effect of having all these cases come in. You know, a lot of them are coming from Silicon Valley or they're coming from New York. You have lawyers coming to town that want to stay there and they're going to be eating at the local restaurants. And then you have big tech companies that both are defendants and plaintiffs in a lot of these cases that, you know, curiously enough, are sponsoring the local skating rink or they're giving scholarships to the high school students in town. So there's definitely some relation there between some benefits for this kind of system.
Well, Kaylee, thanks for giving us a little glimpse of this corner of patent law.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Kaylee Rogers, she's a staff writer for Motherboard, and that's where we found her article, The Small Town Judge Who Sees a Quarter of the Nation's Patent Cases. You'll find a link to read the article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last month, news of a first-of-its-kind transplant in the U.S. made for some grabby headlines. A surgical team at Massachusetts General Hospital announced the experimental urogenital transplant on a 64-year-old man who'd had his penis removed because of cancer. The breakthrough represents hope, especially among combat veterans who feel stigmatized and emasculated by loss or severe injury to the genitals and urinary tract. Suicide rates are especially high among that population. Denise Grady reported the story for the New York Times, where she'd also covered the progress of a surgical team at Johns Hopkins, which has been focusing on wounded troops. Oh, Denise, so great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for inviting me.
So I said urogenital, the term you used. Is it inaccurate to say penis transplant, which was in a lot of headlines?
No, it is completely correct to say a penis transplant. That is exactly what they did.
So what can you tell us about Thomas Manning, who underwent this transplant in May at Mass General?
He is a 64-year-old man. He is a courier for a bank, and he found out that he had this cancer of the penis. He found out about it by accident. He was in an accident at work. Some heavy equipment fell on him. He was very badly injured. And in the course of treating him for these injuries, the doctors noticed that he had this abnormal growth. They did some tests on it, and that was when they discovered that he had cancer. And it was far enough along that the only solution was to remove almost all of the penis to save his life. That was all they could do. So they went ahead and did this a few years ago. And right from the get-go, Mr. Manning was asking, couldn't they do a transplant for him at some point? Nobody was thinking about it at the time. Even the doctors thought he was a little out there. The whole thing seemed a little far-fetched. But then the idea actually began to take hold in medical circles. And a few years later, when they began to really plan it, the doctor who had taken care of him remembered that he had been so gung-ho for this and came back to him and said, do you still want to do this? And he said, you bet, and went ahead and became the first one.
Well, how's he doing now?
He is doing well. He came out of the hospital a few weeks after the surgery. He had regained his ability to urinate normally, to urinate standing up, which is a big deal for a guy. And he was hoping that he would get sexual function back in maybe in a few months. Nobody knows for sure. There was no promise or no guarantee of that. But there is a reasonable good chance that the nerves will grow back together and that will happen for him, too.
Well, you've been following the progress of the penis transplant for some time. No previous candidate for this urogenital transplant at another hospital, Johns Hopkins, wanted to talk with you, but Thomas Manning did. Was that surprising?
I was totally surprised. I went into this expecting that if he was willing to talk at all, that he would want to be anonymous. He might not even want to be in the same room. If we were lucky, maybe he would talk on the phone. And I went out of my way to tell the hospital, you know, readers will understand. People know that this is very intimate and embarrassing, and there's a lot of stigma attached to it, and people don't want anybody to know. And he brushed all of that aside and said, you can use my name. You can ask me any question you want. And I want you to come up here in person and look me in the eye, and I want to talk face to face, and I want to let everybody know there's nothing to be ashamed of. And he has a real warm spot in his heart for these young men who are in the same situation because of combat injuries or maybe other accidents, and he wanted to speak out about it to give other people hope that if something like this happens to you, there may be a chance to fix it.
Oh, there's a whole interview with you and Thomas Manning in the Times. It is just fantastic that he's not accepting the stigma. Now, this was the first time this was done in the U.S. How about anywhere else in the world?
There was one done a few years ago in China that failed pretty quickly, and the recipient requested that it be removed. There, something went wrong with it. It's not entirely clear what happened. Some of the doctors I talked to had seen, you know, medical photographs and said it looked like maybe the blood supply wasn't right or something wasn't working, and the recipient wanted it removed. So that one was a failure. Then there was another one in South Africa for a young man who had a circumcision when he was in his late teens or early 20s that went very badly wrong, and he wound up losing the entire organ. So he had a transplant, and that one worked. He got back sexual function. He was able to get his wife or his girlfriend pregnant.
Wow. So this really is such a breakthrough. But you raise that question of, you know, something attached to you that you can see. Very different than the transplants that we normally think of, which are, you know, internal organs, heart, liver, kidneys, that kind of thing. So is the treatment of donations when it comes to, you know, face transplants, genitalia, is the process different than that for internal organs?
Getting the consent is different. Unless a person who was going to be the donor has specified somehow, yes, you can take my face and my hands or any other organs that you want, it's not assumed that they have given consent. So if you sign an organ donation card or the thing on the driver's license that says you're willing to be an organ donor for kidneys or livers or whatever, there's no assumption made that that means you or your family would also be willing to allow your face or hands to be removed. Some people may find that too disturbing. So the organ procurement organizations, and those are the people that go and talk to the families when somebody is nearing death or on life support and it seems like they might be an organ donor, they go in, they make sure that it's understood that you can still give organs and say no to the face or hands or the penis. So it's a separate, basically they call it a separate ask, and they make sure that the family is okay with this. The Boston group said that they had asked a number of families about penis donations, and nobody said no. And so they had a number that were donated and that were used just for research purposes because the doctors were practicing the operations.
Denise Grady reports on medicine for the New York Times, and we're talking about the first urogenital transplant that she reported on. It took place at Massachusetts General Hospital. But Denise, there was another team that you covered at Johns Hopkins, targeting the combat veteran population especially. Tell us a little bit about this team, and why were they not the first?
They have had a patient on the waiting list for several months, and They just have not had the luck of the matching donor coming up yet. It could happen at any time, but they just haven't had it happen. And Mr. Manning got lucky. I think everybody was surprised because he was on the waiting list for only 2 weeks. There was another patient in Massachusetts at the Mass General who was also on the waiting list and had been listed, I think, before Mr. Manning, and he just happened to be the match for you. You have to match blood type and skin color. So the doctors in Hopkins are still they're waiting, and they had said that they've done hand transplants there, and it took them a while for a donor to come along. Mm-hmm. So it is just a matter of waiting for the donor. And the Mass General Group also wants to offer this to veterans, but they want to get some civilian cases done first as a sort of a practice. And I think their feeling is that the combat injuries are going to be worse and harder to operate on, less controlled than, say, something like Mr. Manning had, because he had surgery that removed the organ. He didn't have it blown off by an IED. Mm. So they are taking it in a stepwise way. They're also in Massachusetts. You know, it's harder for people who are being treated, say, at the military centers, maybe in D.C., to get to them. It might be a little easier to travel to Hopkins if you're in Walter Reed or someplace like that.
Is that frequently the experience of combat veterans, that, you know, the injuries are so severe?
There is an estimate that there's somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 that have what they call urogenital injuries. And that does not mean they've lost the entire penis, but it does mean there's some pelvic injury that could affect the testicles or the penis. So it's not entirely clear just how many might need this operation, but there are enough, and people who treat soldiers at these facilities have seen enough that it made the transplant surgeons want to go to a lot of trouble to get ready to help them.
Yeah, as you point out in the article, nearly all of them under 35 who've been suffered.
It's heartbreaking, and they will all tell you, and Mr. Manning will talk about this. Maybe it's obvious, but it still seems to be worth saying that so much of your identity as a human being and as a man is tied to your anatomy, and I don't think we can get away from that. You can't really separate body and soul as much as we would like to think we can.
So combat veterans and cancer patients now, do you see a day when this might be used for gender reassignment surgery?
The doctors have said that it is theoretically possible, but they're nowhere near it yet. And it would be, if you just think about that, it would be a lot more complicated, a lot more difficult.
The internal organs as well as
the connections. All the things you got to hook up, and the hormones you'll need, and everything else, it would be pretty complicated. But nobody has ruled it out.
Well, Denise Grady, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Denise Grady, she reports on medicine for the New York Times, where she covered the story of the first ever urogenital transplant at Mass General Hospital on a 64-year-old cancer survivor. You can find a link to all of her coverage on the topic at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's been 5 years since the conflict in Syria began. More than 250,000 Syrians have been killed and almost 11 million displaced. Fleeing the country is often a long and perilous journey, especially for members of Syria's maligned LGBT community. Eli Wirtschafter from the KALW series Cross Currents shares an atypical refugee story.
Subi Nahas remembers the exact day when he knew he'd have to leave Syria. It was the spring of 2012. He was 24, on a bus going to university to take a final exam, the last exam he needed to graduate. He says they came up to a checkpoint, and a group of soldiers stopped the bus. They checked the IDs of all the young men, and then they singled out Subi.
They take you to our room and put you in a chair where you're all alone.
These were Syrian government soldiers. They were cracking down on rebels who opposed the president, Bashar al-Assad.
The chairs and the table and the ground, they're full of blood.
Subi had nothing to do with the civil war. But these soldiers decided to pick on him anyway. They'd noticed that he looked different, kind of effeminate. They started mocking him.
They were picking up on me especially because of, you know, look at the way he walks, look at his, you know, dress, look at his hair.
He said for 30 minutes they harassed him and called him homophobic names. He was scared for his life.
And that moment I was like feeling that, yeah, that's the end of it.
It wasn't. They let him go without hurting him. But after that, Subi was too afraid to go back to school.
When I came back home, I was saying to myself, so what's the point of staying in Syria while you cannot complete your studies, and without this, like, you cannot do anything.
The soldiers who messed with Subi were from the Assad regime. But a few months later, rebels who opposed Assad took root in Subi's city. They belonged to al-Nusra Front, which is the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda. For Subi, they were even worse than the regime. They announced that they would, quote, cleanse the city of sodomites.
So I cannot go to university. I cannot go out. So I have to stay home all the time. But then staying at home was not safe too.
Like a lot of LGBT people who become refugees, Subi felt threatened by his own family. His parents never accepted the idea of a gay son. Subi lived at home with them, but his father didn't speak to him.
We sometimes we don't even say good morning to each other, so even when we speak, he never expressed his emotions or feelings and how he does feel about it, except when he's really angry and he wants to express how angry he is.
One day they were in the kitchen. They had a fight and his father lost his temper.
He grabbed my head from the back and he just smashed it into the kitchen counter.
Subi still has a scar on his chin.
If you're not safe outside and you're not safe inside, and your family will not protect you from your father because your father has anger management issues, so you better run. Nobody's going to save you.
He immediately made plans to cross the border into Lebanon, where he had a friend he could stay with. This journey was legal, but he had heard horrible stories about gay people who were raped as they tried to get across. So he bribed a taxi driver to deal with all the checkpoints. Subi sat in the back of the cab and pretended he couldn't talk. He stayed in Lebanon for 6 months. And then he moved to Turkey, where it was a little easier to be gay.
It was a different, completely different experience, especially exploring myself, exploring my sexuality, trying to understand my body more.
But still, he knew he couldn't stay there. Turkey doesn't let any Syrian refugees become citizens. And so he had two options. He could travel to a country like Germany and hope they gave him asylum, or he could apply to the UN, which can resettle refugees to another country. In Turkey, he met a lawyer from a group called ORAM, the Organization for Refuge and Migration. They're based in San Francisco, and they advocate for LGBT refugees around the world. They explained to Subi how the UN program works.
ORAM helped me to understand these interviews and helped me to understand the procedures and what they do and how long it takes.
The UN only resettles people who are part of a persecuted group. One of those groups is LGBT people. But there are 4.5 million Syrian refugees, and less than 1% of them make it through the UN's process.
I never knew that my case would be, like, really accepted.
The process took almost a year. Subi did interview after interview, screening after screening, until one day he found out that he was cleared. Subi flew to California on June 4th, 2015. He even knew who he was going to live with. An older gay couple in Oakland had agreed to be his sponsors, to host him in their home.
Yeah. Well, that is good. Yeah. Very good idea.
Subi is back in the house of his sponsor, Fred Hertz. He lived here for his first 2 months. Subi's slicing off the crown of a dark red pomegranate.
Oh, that's really good. You don't cut it all the way through.
No, because it's easy. Right.
When he lived here, he and Fred got really into cooking together. The pomegranate is going on a roasted eggplant dish, which Subi calls mlatash.
Say it again. Mlatash. Mlatash. M-L.
Fred got involved with LGBT refugee rights 5 years ago.
Here I am, this successful gay lawyer who is, you know, living a very liberated life with a long-term partner. And when someone comes forward and says, there are these gay people who are in trouble in other countries, you know, how can I say no?
But taking a refugee into his own home, that was another level.
I would say my biggest worries were things like, oh my God, what if he gets here and has a nervous breakdown and like locks himself in the room and doesn't come out for 6 months? What am I going to do?
But they got along like family. Subi felt the same way.
They even became vegetarian for a whole month. It was like, I'm vegetarian, so it's like they did not bring meat to the house. That was something I really, really appreciate.
Subi showed me his old room in Fred's house.
And yeah, I used to store stuff in that box. Lots of stuff, especially paperwork, because, you know, in the States, they send everything, like, lots of paper.
His visa, medical exam paperwork, bank documents, his vaccination card. He spent most of his first month here getting all his papers in order.
It's time-consuming, and I think without Fred and his partner, I would have not done it in 1 month, and that I would still, until now, stuck doing all the paperwork.
This was actually part of Fred's commitment as a sponsor. He had a list of all the appointments Subi needed to get to. And when Fred wasn't available, he got his friends to help too. Especially for LGBT refugees, creating that kind of community is essential.
Let's say if you're not an LGBT, you'll be expected to be resettled with your own community. But if you're an LGBT, most of the time you're escaping from your own community, or you're escaping from your family, or you have nobody. So you need somebody to be with you, and you need somebody to help you in the first steps.
Subi has had an amazingly smooth transition into the United States. Some help came from the government. When they first arrive, refugees get a small stipend and they can apply for food stamps and health care. And like almost everybody in the refugee program, Subi's on track to eventually get a green card and U.S. citizenship. But what sets his case apart is the bond he made with Fred and the local gay community. Now, Subi is working at Oram, the same organization he reached out to when he was in Turkey. Subi knows how rare his case is, so he's working to help other refugees make it to the other side. Subi shows me a poster that he designed with Oram. It says the words, "You are safe here," in a dozen languages, in rainbow colors. They're sending it to refugee offices around the world.
You step into the office and you look to the wall and you see this, and you see the rainbow, then you will know that you're safe here, even if you're an LGBT.
Subi has lots of friends who are visiting offices like these in Turkey and Lebanon, waiting for resettlement. But recently, one of Subi's friends also made it through. His name is Nader Turkmani. Subi called him up on Skype after he heard the news. Nader is also gay and Syrian. He petitioned the UN for years. Now he'll be able to move from Turkey to Norway.
Hi.
Subi and Nader started an LGBT support group in Istanbul. Since Subi moved, he's been helping Nader manage the group long distance. Now, they're making plans for when Nader will leave, too.
Hopefully, our group will be there for a long time.
Groups like the one Subi started, or people like Fred and his partner, they give LGBT refugees something they're usually missing, a family that looks out for them.
It's a good feeling when you really know that somebody cares and loves you this much. It's life-changing.
In San Francisco for Cross Currents, I'm Eli Werchafter.
Hello, this is Bill Cunningham, and the fastened message...
And on the way out today, a nod to Bill Cunningham, who died Saturday in New York, the city that was his canvas and muse for more than 40 years. The photographer rode his bicycle around the city, snapping pictures for his weekly street-style feature in the New York Times. By night, he photographed the elites at high-end fundraisers and galas, seemingly with equal exuberance. I can't recommend enough the 2010 documentary Bill Cunningham, New York, which is streaming on Netflix, and which gives us a glimpse of a man who preferred to be invisible, and in a fashion age dominated by celebrity, quite egalitarian.
I'm not interested in celebrities with their free dresses. I'm interested in clothes.
Over the weekend, I read that Bill Cunningham got his start taking pictures at the New Hampshire ski resorts he visited while growing up. His subjects may not have been as varied as New Yorkers, but I'd like to think it was a hardy training ground for a guy who rode his bike around in rain, snow, and sleet to get the perfect shot. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.